Sorry, Paul, I didn't do a complete bio of you in order to introduce you. I kind of see you as a friend of Ilam. You've spoken to us before here with us. You know people from Ilam, so you're a friendly and warm face. So do come on up. Paul, I thought would be a really good person to encourage us to reflect a lot more on our own treaty journey. And it was a place we came to last week, that sense that actually we've got a lot of journeying with the treaty ourselves to be able to share with each other. But from Paul, who has been in his life a pastor, a teacher, he's a hunter, he reflects on life from a whole lot of different aspects. He's also been someone who's been very much an encourager within the Baptist churches of New Zealand and in a wider context here in Christchurch of exploring our relationship with the treaty and what it means. And I thought it would be a really good opportunity to invite Paul to share this morning about his journey with the treaty. Now, that may be what he is going to do. It may be that he's got some other ideas that have come to him along the way as he's prepared, but that's the general idea. So, Paul Askin, now retired, no, not really retired, you're very active, a very active man, but retired from formal employment, but reflections on being a pastor, the treaty, a teacher, New Zealand, life, everything, whatever you like. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Peter. Nā mihi ki te whānau o te riki o te hahi iriri o Ilam, kua hui mai nei ki tēnei whare kura, he whare karakia te rānei. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Greetings, Ilam Baptist. It's great to be here with you in your schoolhouse, which you have turned into a house of prayer today, which you do regularly, of course. And it's a privilege and a delight to be here with you. Leslie's not able to come with me today. She's at church elsewhere with our daughter-in-law and two grandchildren, which I think is great. I listened to Sam Carpenter during the week because I heard about this very erudite man that you had come and speak to you with this amazing background that he has. I really enjoyed listening to him, and I need to tell you, you're going to get something a little different today. I'm going to share about a personal journey with the treaty, and I realised that I want to start by talking about my relationship with Māori, the world, the experiences I've had, because I think there's some, well, I hope, you can tell me afterwards whether it's interesting or not. First up, a personal story, which I've never done like this before today, so that was interesting preparing that. And then secondly, some thoughts around the treaty and experiences in that. And then I want to finish up by talking about the gospel. And I also need to let you know at the beginning that I do have an ulterior motive. That's the subject I'm going to talk about. But actually, what I really want to do today is encourage you as followers of Jesus. And for those who are followers, I really want to encourage you on that journey and inspire you to keep going and do well. And if you're not on that journey yet, then I just really want to encourage you to consider it and be part of following Jesus. So there's the subversive agenda out in the open. So let's get going. I was born in Christchurch, of which as a kid I was very proud, being a South Islander, because, and I'm not telling you when because it's a while ago, but we lived in the North Island, and at the time when I was born, my parents were living in a very remote part of the North Island in Tūhoe country, up past Rotorua, past Murupara, into the hills, on the way to Ruatahuna and Lake Waikaremoana. There's an intersection on the road called Te Whaiti, and you turn off down to what was then a thriving mill town, Minganui. It's not thriving anymore. And Dad was a staff member at a Presbyterian farm school, catering for young Māori men from all around the North Island. Because in those days, post-war, many boys left school before they hit high school or with very little high school experience. They went home to help on small family farms. So at the Presbyterian Farm School, and I'm sorry, it was just for boys, not girls, but there you go. They did classroom stuff, literacy and numeracy and that kind of thing, which was my father's responsibility. And in the afternoon, they did farm work, learning farm skills and so on. Before joining Dad at Te Whaiti, Mum had been a public health nurse at Pipariki, way up the Whanganui River. And these were two interesting career choices for both of them, both from Canterbury, choices made long before they met. So my earliest memories are growing up in Te Whaiti, this very remote rural Māori community, among many Māori, all the young fellas on the farm. And then when I was about four, we moved to Auckland, and we ended up living in Panmure. And at this time, my father was a board member for the United Māori Mission. Quite a vibrant work in those days. There were a few missionaries stationed in rural areas, and they also ran dynamic trade training hostels in Auckland, one in Gillies Ave, one in Owens Road, and one for girls in Hepburn Road, overlooking the harbour bridge as it is now. Yeah. And a highlight for me each year as a kid was going to the United Māori Mission Festival, which was held on a Sunday afternoon in the Baptist Tabernacle. And they filled the Baptist Tabernacle with song and testimonies and laughter and musical items and a message. And as a kid, I loved the excitement and buzz of those events. Young Māori, many of them new believers, celebrating the gospel together. Out of the United Māori Mission and the hostels was birthed the Māori Evangelical Fellowship Movement to cater for Māori Christians. It wasn't easy for many of these believers to find a place of welcome, a place to belong to in the churches of that time, and sadly too little has changed. And so on Sundays we attended Māori Evangelical Fellowship service in a little rented hall in Glen Innes, GI as it's known these days, a small gathering of Māori and Pākehā people sharing together. And then when I was about 10 or 11, Mum and Dad made a momentous announcement to us as a family. We were going to upstate, leave our home in Panmure, and we were shifting to Northland. And Dad was no longer going to be a board member for the United Māori Mission, he was going to be a missionary. Well, Kawakawa and Moirua were the chosen communities for us. And so I did most of my high school years at Bay of Islands College in Kawakawa. We had services in homes, hui on marae, Mum and Dad with lots of Bible and schools teaching and visiting in remote rural areas around that part of the world. And our home and its grounds were occasionally the venue for a camp. And every Easter, there was a big camp held at Okaiho District High School, and people came from all over the north to share in those occasions, Māori and Pākehā together. And every Waitangi Day, we'd make the short trip from our home over to Waitangi to see the festivities and be part of celebrating the treaty. And they were very different events in those days. This is in the 1960s. The Governor-General, and I remember Sir Bernard Ferguson and other Governor-Generals, and they would ponce around in these most amazing get-ups, you know, funny hats with white tassels all over the place and very colonial. It was, you know, and the army band would play. There'd be speeches and a flag ceremony from memory. And when it got dark, a bit I really liked was when they turned the lights on in the naval ships out in the bay. You're nodding them, yeah. Yeah, it was a good night out, standing under the trees on the treaty grounds and being there. Not really understanding too much about it, but knowing it must be important. At school, I studied French. Māori was not an option offered at Bay of Islands College. And I well remember doing weeks of work in social studies classes, Form 3, learning about feudal England. Yeah, you know, and the manor house and the common ground and the peasants and all, yeah, and drawing pictures of all this stuff. It seemed endless. But you know what? We never learned anything from memory about the treaty, which all happened just down the road. Bay of Islands College didn't have a seventh form in those days, so my last year of school was at a boarder at Auckland Grammar. And boy, was I a fish out of water down there. No fun. But it was very handy to Gillies Ave Hostel, the hostel I mentioned earlier. So I used to pop over, climb through the fence and hang out with the young men there who would be playing ping pong and strumming guitars and sitting in the sun and giving each other cheek, and I felt at home in that kind of environment. And then after that, it was off to Lincoln University, back to the south for me. And I enjoyed Lincoln very much, my 4 years out there. But again, I was a bit of a misfit. I wasn't a good fit with the moleskin trousers, checked shirt, riding boots, homespun jersey set, who went skiing every weekend. I just didn't quite fit that. And my name is Askin, and some of those people knew Askins in Mid-Canterbury who are, farming people and so on, but somehow I didn't quite, fit in. But I discovered it soon after I got to Lincoln, the Open Door, which was run by the Anglican City Mission at that time, a drop-in centre in the middle of town. And I volunteered every Monday night, and I would turn up at the Open Door, and I would hang out for the evening till 10 o'clock when they closed, and there'd be kids playing ping pong and on a beat-up pool table, and there'd be some food and television going and that kind of thing. There were street kids there, many of whom were Māori, and there were older alcoholic men, and I went mainly for my own sanity, really, not to do a lot of good, because I was hanging out with more my own kind of people. And the upshot of all this was that when I finished my degree at Lincoln, I was invited by Maurice Goodall, the Anglican City Missioner, to join the staff team. So I became assistant manager and then manager of the Open Door. And I figured it worked because I'd been trained in pastoral schools at Lincoln, and now I was doing a pastoral job of a slightly different. During my Lincoln years, I attended a little-known Baptist church in the suburbs of Christchurch, somewhere down Littleton Street, led by a fresh-faced young pastor by the name of Murray Robertson. And at that time, a group of us set up a community house in the Anglican Vicarage in Church Square. My Anglican connections working for the mission helped out there. So there was a group of us associated with the Open Door and with Spraydon Baptist. And the idea was that we would have a home, a place where young people from the Open Door could come and get established for a new life. And we had some great times there. Loads of youthful enthusiasm and vitality and bucket loads of idealism. And we had some really exciting times. I remember one night in bed dreaming that one of my Open Door friends who was living with us at the time was sitting on the end of my bed waving a carving knife around, threatening himself and me and anybody else who was around. And to my surprise, when I woke up, he was still there. Leslie and I got married in 1975, and soon after, Murray Robertson invited me to join him on the staff. It's Braden as it was then. And so Murray and I were the staff team for some time, and I was in that role for 3 years, and they were very exciting times. And then in 1978, Leslie and I, with our little son Peter and a baby on the way, Stephen, I accepted a call to be the Baptist missioner down in Central Otago. And we were there until 1982, when I accepted a call to Orake in Auckland, just up the road from Bastion Point. However, within a couple of months of arriving in Orake, I contracted hepatitis B, and I went to bed for 3 months. It's not the ideal beginning to a new pastoral appointment. And the next 3 years which followed were extremely difficult, quite rough due to my poor health. I'd been wiped out by the hepatitis, and eventually, somewhat depressed, my wife tells me, I resigned, and we came back to Canterbury. My grandparents' old cottage on the farm at Hoorata, the family farm, was empty, and so we stayed there, and I was on a sickness bed for a while. And then we moved to Hoon Hay and reconnected with Spraydon, and for some obscure reason, I still quite don't work this out, I thought it'd be a good idea to become a high school teacher. And so I went off to teacher's college. And while I was there, I did really well because I managed to, I think the right word is, I conned them into letting me leave teacher's college and go to Polytech and do two six-week courses in Māori language, which was good. Teachers College didn't help me much in terms of teaching, but the polytech courses were great. And also at the time, Spraydon, it was known then, was taking tentative steps, and a little bicultural group had started, and Leslie and I were part of that. Well, after the year at Teachers College soon came to an end, the end was coming, and what were we going to do next? Teaching jobs in Christchurch, Canterbury were hard to come by. Where were we going to go? Take our family. And a left-field idea developed. If we were serious about this cultural understanding stuff, Canterbury, we figured, wasn't exactly the ideal setting. How about I apply for a job in some rural, remote, Māori area up north? And guess what? In the Gazette, I discovered there was a science teacher needed at Ngata Memorial College in Ruatoria. Now, back in those days, the late 1980s, Ruatoria was regularly on the news. The older ones will remember that. And what was it on the news for? Mayhem. Anarchy. There was a Rastafarian group there led by Chris Campbell, Diesel Dick and others, and they were involved in setting fires, cutting fences, killing stock, burning properties down, and even a murder or two, as well as growing loads of dope. When I told my tutor, Carr Daniels, at the Polytech Māori Language course that I was going to apply for a teaching job up in Ruatoria, she was not that encouraging. She said to me, "You're mad taking your family up there. They'll eat you." Fortunately, she was wrong. And guess what? There was only one applicant for the job. So reluctantly, the principal appointed me. He wanted to appoint a Māori, and I was Pākehā. Then things got a whole lot worse when he discovered that I was a Christian. He was a powerful advocate of old Māori ways and beliefs, the Atua Māori, and was clearly anti-Christian, and it was a major disappointment to him to have to appoint not just a Pākehā, but a Pākehā Christian onto his staff. And for some of my 6 years at Ngata College, I was the only Pākehā in the whole school, staff or student. So I certainly got myself an immersion experience. And if Leslie was here this morning, one of the things that she would have said to you was, it's a really helpful thing sometimes to be in the minority. You can learn stuff when you're in the minority that you'll never learn otherwise. And we were in the minority. A couple of stories, just quick stories from Ngata, my time at Ngata College. I was the science and horticulture teacher, and I would take kids up into the horticulture unit, and we'd dig and do stuff and plant and grow. And we were digging over a bit of ground one day, half a dozen boys and me, and five of them dropped out, and there's only Dallas Heinger and me digging. And then he leans on his shovel, and he looks me in the eye, and he makes a statement to me. And he says, "You know, sir, Pākehā's the all shit." And I was a bit stunned. It came out of nowhere. And so to give myself time to think about this, "What was that, Dallas?" He says, "Pākehā's all shit." And so I looked him in the eye and I said to him, "So where does that leave me?" That was an interesting thing. And I actually took that as a compliment in the end. There was another young, a part of the horticulture unit, we grew willow poles, you know, they cut them down and poke them in the ground and grow a tree, and it helps stabilise eroding hills. And erosion is a huge issue up in the east coast, that area. And one of my students, armed with his loppers, was walking along and cutting them in half, which was completely ruining, not pruning the little branches off the side, but just chopping them in half and destroying them. "Hey, Ian, what are you doing?" He said, "They're just bloody Pākehā trees anyway." And I said, "Yes, they are, but they're really good for holding Māori hillsides together." So it was never a dull moment. Life in Ruatoria. When we arrived up there, we asked around about local churches. I thought getting a non-believer's perspective on the churches was going to be an interesting bit of insight to help us decide what we were going to do. And I was told about the Gospel Hall, a whare rungopai, and a Pākehā couple there, Horace and Lois Hayden, who were key figures in that little fellowship. He was a mechanic at Timberlands. They did Bible in schools, and they had a wonderful reputation for honesty and generosity and graciousness in the local community. So that's where we rocked up on our first Sunday. And there was a small group, a number of Māori folks, Wally and Podge Tennity and their kids, and Dallas Collier and Papa Kawhia and others, and there were Horace and Lois, and there was another Pākehā couple, Barbara and Alex Reed. Barbara was a midwife down at Tapuia Springs Hospital, just south a bit, and Alex was the dentist at the hospital. Barbara loved the young women who came into the hospital to have a baby, and it didn't matter who they were and what their issues were and what was going on in their situation, she just loved and cared for them all. And when their baby was born, she had this tradition. She was a very good cook, and she would bake a magnificent, big, huge sponge cake, decorated with cream and the whole works, and present it, and the mothers in the unit would celebrate the birth of a baby. And one day, Horace said to me after school, he said, would I be willing to go with him to visit a young couple in Ruatoria who just had a baby? Barbara had some great conversations with Gracie, and Horace knew Wetini through the forestry activity. And so I said, well, yeah, I'll come. And so the next Tuesday night, we rocked up to Gracie and Wetini's home and had a cup of tea, sat around the table and had a chat. And they were interested in Christian faith because that's what Barbara, part of what Barbara had been talking to Gracie about. And shall we come back next week? Yes, please do. And then after a little while, can we invite Timmy and Horowai, Hainga, to come and be part of it? Horowai was another new mum that just had a baby. And so we had a small home group. It kind of just grew. And numbers of other people came, and there were baptisms and there were weddings. And something really exciting started to develop in that. Also at the time, since this is supposed to have some Treaty of Waitangi connections, in 1990 we got this very random phone call one afternoon from Lee Tamahori, who's a Māori fellow from up there, well-known New Zealand film director. He was making ads at the time. He'd been commissioned by some government outfit to produce ads for the 150th celebration of the Treaty of Waitangi, which were going to be voiced over by Dame Te Atakahi, the Māori Queen at the time, lovely lady, and they needed a Pākehā boy and a Māori boy. Well, there are loads of Māori boys up the East Coast, but not many Pākehā ones, especially blonde and blue-eyed Pākehā boys, and can we have Steve in our ad? And I was a bit shocked yesterday, looking up some stuff on the web about the New Zealand history Te Ara, and there's a photograph of my son Steve and Pee Wee from down the road, the two boys who did those three ads. So that's a little aside. So that, where's Peter? A bit of Treaty of Waitangi information that's actually totally irrelevant. I found the school environment at Ngata really difficult. A few more stories I could tell you, but I don't think I was really cut out to be a fantastic high school teacher. And Leslie tells me I wasn't always easy to live with at home at times in those days. It was a very challenging environment. Marijuana was a real problem up there, electric puha, as they like to call it. And kids would have a joint standing on the roadside waiting for the school bus to come along. So they'd be well set up for the day. And they'd have a smoke behind the bushes at school if they got the chance. And one of the neighbours of the school found tucked away in the bushes, not a joint, but a 10-litre pail full of marijuana. Somebody had bought a decent supply so they would never run out. And one day a bunch of kids came into my classroom and told me the principal had told them that there should be no churches on Marae. It's not right. They don't belong. It's a Pākehā intrusion. Māori have Māori gods. And that led into a rather interesting discussion. Another day, and another principal also didn't like Pākehā Christians very much. We were having an outdoor assembly in the quad of the school, and I was standing there among the other teachers, and as I want to do, I had my hands in my pockets. And in front of the whole school, my friendly headmaster said to me, "Askin, what are you doing with your hands in your pockets?" You'll never guess what he said next. "Playing pocket billiards, are you?" In front of the school. You can imagine how much the kids loved that one, and I wasn't able to put my hands in my pockets for some weeks afterwards. So I'm I'm just trying to paint a picture of the kind of challenges and the joys that we went through in that environment. And we didn't feel that we could put our boys, when they got to high school age, one after the other, into that environment at school. You know, having your old man as a teacher is not a smart move. And so friends in Gisborne boarded them Monday to Friday, and separating the family was not easy. It was not an easy choice to make. And sending them off on Monday morning was no fun, and picking them up on Friday afternoon was absolutely marvellous. We treasured the weekends and the school holidays. But at the same time, exciting things were happening. Sunday mornings in the Wharerongapai, and it was very brethren. You never knew quite what was going to happen, who was going to do what. And when it was really amazing, it was fantastic. And when it wasn't so great, it really wasn't that great. But the gathering of people grew, and we always had a lunch and a long chat and share in the afternoon, because people came from all over the place, some distance. And at the same time, the Tuesday night gatherings had developed where we were regularly getting 25, 30 people jamming into a lounge in different homes. And there'd be, you know, somebody strumming the guitar, and there'd be songs, and there'd be stories told, and a Bible study. And at the time, we just did what was in front of us, what was needed to be done. You know, life always has challenges, doesn't it? You just got to keep on keeping on with the fun times and the hard times. But looking back now, and it took me some years to do this, I see more clearly how God was at work, quietly changing lives and growing disciples. And one of the things I only realised years later was, you know, in all those years working together, Māori and Pākehā, we never talked about the treaty once. And in fact, we never even discussed what biculturalism was. I don't think the word ever came up. We never talked about it. But we were doing it. We had a bunch of people who wanted to be followers of Jesus, apprentices of Jesus, and we had a selection of gifts and abilities among us, and we tried to use the gifts that we had and grow all the people, me included. And as I look back, and it was only when we went back up there 20 years later, after we'd left, we were invited back as a family for a kawemate after we lost our son. And the locals invited us to come back as the whole family. We were welcomed onto Marae, and we stayed on that Marae for a number of days and just hung out with people and went around the place. And it was only then that I realised just some of the stuff that God had been doing in people's lives as we caught up with one another and people told stories. And Leslie and I are really looking forward to being back up there for 3 weeks next month. These days, how am I going? Yeah. I'm involved with Te Raranga, interchurch organisation here that grew out of the sort of post-quake environment, and there's a bicultural strand to that I'm part of. It took me some years to realise that my upbringing was a bit different from average Kiwi, especially average Kiwi in Canterbury. But it has, and I'm very thankful, even though there were lots of challenges and, you know, I felt the odd one out plenty of times, I'm thankful for the opportunities that God brought my way through those experiences, and they enrich my life now. Okay, so that's part one. Part two is a bit shorter. My whakapapa is Irish and Scots from Orkney and English. My origins are obviously the other side of the world, in a very different world. But I'm here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and I'm privileged and so delighted to call this place home. Now, often when new people, you know, like my lot, arrive and settle in the land, it's as a result of conquest. Their tribe have been stronger than the ones there, you know, and they've taken over. Or it's sometimes as a result of a lie. You know, this is an empty land, nobody lives here, nobody owns it, we can just move in and take over. But I stand here in this country, on this land, not as a result of conquest, and not because of some kind of lie, but I'm here because of a treaty. Yeah? That's the ground on which I stand, isn't it? There was this treaty all those years ago that was signed in good faith by leaders of the people who owned the land and the representatives of the newcomers. And the treaty spells out rights and responsibilities. And it was a win for justice and fairness. It absolutely was. And there were Christian people like Sir James Stevens in the Colonial Office in London who recognised the huge damage that the British Empire had done in its colonising around the world and damage to Indigenous people. And Sir James Stevens and others wanted to see things done better in this country. And so had a significant influence on what happened leading up to that proposal of a treaty. Dr. Claudia Orange has observed that initial plans of a Māori Aotearoa New Zealand that somehow accommodated European settlers, because that's what they were thinking back in 1840, was replaced with a settler New Zealand that would somehow retain a place for Māori. So the treaty was a victory for fairness and justice, but sadly the victory didn't last very long. Subsequent treatment of the treaty was a clear win for the power of greed, racism and bigotry. It was a win for the empire. And the change didn't take long in coming. Two quick examples. 2 months after the treaty was signed, Governor Hobson appointed a protector of the Aboriginals, an Anglican missionary by the name of George Clark, to look after Māori interests and to implement the promises of the treaty relating to land ownership and sale and so on. And this man had 5 regional offices around the country, but he wasn't popular with Pākehā. He was a very fluent Māori speaker, and the Pākehā felt that he took the Māori side far too often. When Governor Gray arrived, he abolished that particular, the protectorate, in 1846. So it's only 6 years after the signing of the treaty. The protectorate was abolished, and Governor Gray said that he would take on that responsibility for himself. And in this capacity, he oversaw the government purchase of much of the South Island, some 30 million acres of land, as well as 3 million acres in the North Island. His agenda was pretty clear. He was concerned that nothing would hamper the process of colonisation. And so it grieves me, I live in the shadow of Mount Grey, and I most often much prefer to use its proper name, I call it, the Maungatere, the floating mountain. And the Grey River's just not far away. I was driving down the side of it the other day. He is honoured in our nation in a way that I think is not really helpful. A quick aside, some years ago there was a discussion, you know, the New Zealander of the year, and the New Zealand Herald said, you know, back if we'd had the New Zealander of the year in Governor Gray's time, he would have definitely been the person. The settlers and the colonists loved him. He would have been New Zealander of the year. But the New Zealand Herald said that in reflection, he was not the man who should have been, and I didn't write his name down, but a wonderful Christian Māori leader, Tarapipi, it'll come to me maybe, but an outstanding Christian leader, imbued with the gospel, who worked tirelessly for Māori with the political leaders of the time. He was, according to the New Zealand Herald, he should have been the New Zealander of the year. Another quick story, Sir James Prendergast was Chief Justice in New Zealand 1875 to 1899. And there was, in a ruling about some land in Pōrerua, the Wee Parata versus the Bishop of Wellington case, 1877, and it was about some land that Māori had provided to the church. We give you the land and you put up a school. Well, and that the land was given in 1848 and the school never eventuated. And the Māori were wanting the land back. But Sir James said in his ruling that the treaty was worthless because it had been signed between a civilised nation and a group of savages who were not capable of signing a treaty. Since the treaty had not been incorporated into domestic law, it was a simple nullity. And Tāpuni O'Regan likes to talk about the treaty as a rat-nibbled nullity. And that particular decision established a legal precedent of great significance and influenced decision-making on Treaty of Waitangi issues for many decades. And that ruling was used to justify the alienation of much Māori land. Didn't take long for things to change, did it? And so I find this story of broken promises, duplicity, greed, and blatant injustice deeply distressing. This is deeply distressing in the land, this wonderful, beautiful, glorious land in which I live. And of course, it's my tribe, people like me, who are the ones who have benefited from the injustice. And it's really distressing too that the Christians who were involved and did all they could in so many ways weren't able to win. And they were just steamrolled and what happened has happened. Craig Vernal, who was Baptist national leader a few years ago in a speech at Waitangi, he described the church at the time of the signing of the treaty as being the midwife. We were not signatories to the treaty, of course. That was Maori leaders and representatives of the Crown, but Christian leaders were the midwife to that particular process, and Maori leaders who were there and heard him say that liked and felt that description was pretty apt. And of course, in our world today, there are people who think the Christian gospel is simply about getting your personal sins forgiven and your promise of heaven for when you check out of this life, and nothing to do with things like a treaty and economics and all that other kind of stuff. And I think people who think that way need to think again. I came across a great Brian Zand line just recently. Jesus has not been reduced to the secretary of afterlife affairs. And I think, there are tendencies in the church that, being a Christian just sort of a spiritual thing, very personal, very private, and about going to heaven, and that's it. No. It touches every part of our lives. So there you go. And treaties are important. In the Old Testament, there's a story of Joshua, an Old Testament hero who made a peace treaty with some people called the Gibeonites, and he promised them safety. What he didn't know was that they'd tricked him. He'd been the victim of a con job, really. The Gibeonites weren't telling the whole truth, but the treaty stood. And it was honoured. Until King Saul came along some time later, and he attacked and killed loads of Gibeonites. And God saw what had been done, and that the treaty was broken and was not pleased. And the story makes it very clear there were serious repercussions because of that. Treaties, like the Treaty of Waitangi, are human constructs. They're not divine, but they are important. And keeping your promises matters, and it matters to God. And it matters for us as a nation, keeping our promises. So where does all this leave you and me now? Tangata whenua and tangata tiriti. We're in one camp or the other. We're part of the tangata whenua, the people of the land, or we're tangata tiriti. Whatever nationality and ethnicity we are, we've arrived here, and we're here, standing here, because of the treaty. And for me, it means that the treaty is a living document, 182 years on, still to be honoured and still to be lived up to by all of us in this land. It's not something that you can settle and put away in a cupboard. It's something that we continue to live and work out in our relationships together. And of course, we've made some wonderful progress in our country since the statements of the likes of Sir James Prendergast. But of course, there's still a long way to go. And so I thank God for the Treaty of Waitangi, and for the Waitangi Tribunal, and for the apologies given and the settlements, that have been paid, small though they are in proportion to what was lost. I think that we as Christians can give thanks to God for those things having happened in our country. I think it's really, really exciting. And I long and pray for us, people who own the name of Jesus, to be leaders in honouring and living the treaty. Leaders, not people who are dragging the chain, last to the party, but trendsetters, out front, leading not so much in word, but in deed, living the partnership that the treaty describes, living out that inspirational document, that agreement that was made. And I think that we can be, if we choose to be, out front in that, in our communities, and set an example by what we do. Tangata whenua, standing tall, noble and strong, like mighty Totara. Tangata tiriti, thriving, growing well. And I kind of liken myself to being a bit like a Pinus radiata. Not from here, but Pinus radiata seemed to do better here than what they did back in California. producing a harvest of good trim. Unfortunately, Pinus radiata can become a problem weed as well, but I won't go there. So I give great thanks for the treaty and am delighted that it's there. But the last thing I want to say is, what if there was no treaty? What would change for us? How would life change for you and me? I say, as I've already, you know, said, let's give thanks for the treaty and live and honour it. But if it wasn't there, would anything change? You know, the treaty sets the bar this high in terms of our relationships and honouring one another and working together. Where does the gospel set the bar? Lower? Of course not. The gospel bar is far higher, isn't it? In terms of how we respect and honour and relate together as people with all our various differences. I'm indebted to a Māori Catholic theologian, Dominic O'Sullivan. He brings a really, truly a Christian perspective to this, and he honours the treaty. He says it's a human construct, but there's a divine one, which is the challenge for us to live up to as God's people. We're followers of the man who said no way to the temptation to exercise power the way it's exercised in the world. The man who talked about the rulers of this world and the way they lorded over people and exercised authority, and those marvellous words he said, not so with you. He says, I came to give my life and to serve and give my life, and you do the same. And he came and he brought a new kingdom into this world with a subversive, countercultural understanding of power. Not the love of power, which we see all around us, but the power of love. Love that's selfless, grace-filled, and generous. And he came to establish a whole new way of being human, a new community in his name that's inevitably at odds with the world that we're in, but not part of. The new community in Jesus' name, that's just a long way of saying church, it's no add-on. It's not an optional extra. It's a transformation from the inside out, and it's a different way to perceive reality. And that inevitably makes us, as Jesus followers, if we've decided to follow him, we're going to be at the very least interesting and challenging. Often it makes us deeply unsettling and jarring. We're discordant with the world round about us because we respond to situations and questions of life in very different ways. Alan Crider, in a book about the beginnings of the church, writes about the Roman world of that time and the unfreedom characterized by addictive behavior in four key areas. And he talks about sexual ethics, the occult, wealth and possessions, violence and xenophobia. And he says, these things are all potent and seductive, but they're expressions of demonic power and manipulation. And I think he's right, and it wasn't just back then it was like that. It's very similar to that in our world today. Sung Chang Ra, a Korean pastor and theologian whom I've enjoyed reading, says, let's have a public demonstration of the gospel through racial reconciliation, social service, social action, and justice. Yeah? Let's be the revolutionary community where there is neither Jew or Greek, Maori or Pākehā, Chinese nor American, neither rich nor poor, male or female. And of course, we stay who we are. But together, all that variety is like a kaleidoscope that's just so rich and colourful and vibrant. You know, I am who I am. I don't become some, you know, what's it, a coffee-coloured person out of the melting pot. We are who we are, but together there's this wonderful richness. And so I want to finish by quoting Cyprian, who was bishop in Carthage in North Africa a long time ago, 250. He was faced with loads of problems. There was conflict among the believers. There was hostility from the empire. Cyprian himself was martyred in 258. And there had been a pandemic which had taken innumerable lives. And in this context, he wrote to the believers, encouraging them to embody the Christian good news, bearing it in their bodies and actions, living the message visibly and faithfully so that outsiders would see what Christians are all about. And 2 years before he was executed, this is what he wrote. Beloved brethren, we are philosophers, not in words, but in deeds. We exhibit our wisdom not by our dress, but by truth. We know virtues by their practice rather than through boasting of them. And I love his last line. We do not speak great things, but we live them. And that's what God is calling us as his people, to live, value the treaty, and live the gospel, and be discordant in the world where we live. God bless you. Thank you.